Emotions are an important part of religious life for many people. Individuals often describe a certain feeling or sense of passion during a religious practice, even if they can't exactly name what that feeling is. Academics have taken an interest in measuring and understanding this phenomenon, but not everyone agrees on exactly how to do that. Is emotion biological? Is it cultural? What combination? And what could studying emotion and religion tell us about issues like religious intolerance or violence? Scholars are convening in Durham to talk about that topic. The National Humanities Center is hosting a conference tomorrow with some sessions open to the public. I'm joined now by three of those scholars for a preview. John Corrigan is a fellow at the National Humanities Center and the conference convener. He's a professor of religion and history at Florida State University. John Corrigan, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank.
Also with us, Sarah Ross, an ethnomusicologist at the University of Bern in Switzerland. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you, Frank.
And with us, Donovan Schaefer, a scholar of religion at Oxford University in the UK. Hello, Donovan.
Hi, Frank.
So let me start with you, John. Maybe you can describe the premise or the goal of this conference.
Well, for so long, we've been trying to figure out what it is that emotion has to do with religion. This isn't just scholars at the 20th century or early 21st century America. It goes back a couple of millennia. And so we're kind of carrying forward something that's been going on for a long time. But there's been so much done in the study of emotion in the last 25 or 30 years. It's time finally to begin to figure out a way to apply those insights to the study of religion. And so one of the things we're especially concerned with is what does it mean when somebody says, for example, that they hate somebody else? And what does it mean when somebody says they're angry? And what does it mean when somebody says, I'm jealous? All those are emotions. What does it mean in a religious context for those things to happen? How much of that can we figure out? How much can we parse? How much can we break down into components to understand it better?
Of course, the first problem you run into, and neurobiology in recent years has helped complicate this, the idea of emotion as sort of over and against reason is something that we have to start thinking a little more flexibly about that and have a more nuanced view. These aren't Spock and McCoy kinds of persona that present themselves when we talk about emotion and what it is, right?
Yeah, that's excellent. You know, there's kind of a bias we've had for a long time. It's still kind of, you know, in the bones of the way all of us think that there's something about emotion that is irrational or non-rational, and it's secretly hiding within us. That's something we have to get past. We have to figure out a way in which to connect the way people think with the way they feel, something philosophers and biologists and others have been doing now for a couple of good decades and making progress. We've got to push that further. We've got to figure out what it is. Is religious hatred something that can be broken down more into understandable components having to do with belief and ideas, or are we going to let it remain mysterious?
Well, Donovan, I mean, it is a central tenet, and I'm not speaking disparagingly at all to say that religion deals precisely with the irrational part of the brain. You cannot have faith and have reason at the same time, in the sense that if I have faith in something, it's precisely that thing which I cannot prove to the satisfaction of my reasonable faculties, right? I mean, faith and religion deals with that part of the human experience that is just beyond what I can prove, at least today. Am I fair in characterizing it that way?
Yeah. I mean, I think just because you can't prove something doesn't mean that it's strictly speaking irrational. I mean, I think following on your conversation with John, a lot of people would want to move beyond the idea that we need to have a strict divide between the rational and the emotional. I mean, the way that scientists even will talk about knowledge production practices in their laboratories relies a lot on hunches. It relies a lot on intuitions. It relies a lot on a sense of how things work that isn't necessarily something that they could submit proofs for.
And your research looks at how emotion shapes systems of power, right?
Right.
Well, tell us about that.
Mm-hmm. So I'm interested in the idea that a lot of contemporary scholarship in the humanities has been focused on language. And I think what John was rightly pointing out is that language is only one aspect of religion. This is something that John and his work has been saying for 20 or 30 years. If we catalog the aspects of religion and we overlook emotion, then we are producing ultimately an insufficient account of what religion is. My argument would be that those emotional aspects aren't just part of the picture. They're also one of the most important parts. They're, in many ways, what it is that makes religion such a powerful force in our lives is the emotional aspect rather than just beliefs.
Sarah, you take a look at this from the point of view of music and its impact, particularly in Jewish traditions. Tell us about that.
Well, yeah. So my point is that Judaism is not only a rigid religion of laws and prohibitions. It's also about spirituality and emotions. And in terms of music, it's very much about how people connect to Judaism through music. And until now, most of the research has been focusing on how a cantor puts his emotions into the music and how he creates emotional ups and downs throughout the services, how he directs the community to important and not so important parts of the liturgy. But I think now we have also to look on the community itself. So how does the individual worshiper perceive the emotion that the cantor tries to convey through the music? And in this case, we do have a lot of practical issues that kind of makes it hard to really study this part of the perception of emotion. Because we are, for example, if we want to study the Shabbat service, we are not allowed to use any technical devices, for example. So how can we study, how can we cannot make audio recordings or recordings of physical behavior.
No heart monitors, no, yeah.
Right, but yeah. My point is that we actually do need these kinds of data and combine it with the ethnographic data that we collect in interviews, for example. So that we can get a closer and more comprehending picture of how people actually perceive emotion in ritual contexts.
And this, I take it, John, is part of the problem that we, again, and I think, Donovan, you put your finger on it as well, that when we study religion, we sort of look at the rules, look at how it's laid out, what are the dogma, and how do people, and then sort of what impact does that have culturally if we want to expand it. But you're taking a look at this from a much more subjective view. How do I, as an individual, what do I take from it, right? And how does the part that it doesn't get described in the catalog have an impact on how I perceive myself in the world?
Well, you know, I once got into a conversation with somebody about their born-again experience, and I kept trying to ask them about what it was. And we kept running up against brick walls, and finally the person said, well, you know, if you haven't had that feeling, you'll never know what it is. Right? And it opened my eyes to the fact that although we're willing to talk about doctrine, we're willing to talk about, you know, different kinds of devotional practices, scripture and whatnot, after a while, it all kind of falls back upon this notion of the mystery of religion, which is in effect represented by what is thought to be the mystery of emotion. And, you know, it's this kind of double whammy. You know, we've got to find a way to figure out how to talk about emotion, because until we do, we really can't talk about religion very well. So to answer your question, we need a better vocabulary to start with, you know?
Well, and one of the ways to get at this, Donovan, would be to see what are the essential qualities of this? What do people across cultures and across religions report that could be seen as in common? Would that be helpful?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there's a lot of controversy in the sciences and in the humanities about how much we can point to different emotional experiences as being valid across cultural contexts. I tend to think that, by and large, we're going to see the same emotions coming up across cultural contexts. But I think that it would be dangerous to lean too heavily on that, precisely because the expression of those emotions is going to vary so much from time to time and from place to place.
Well, Sarah, and I guess without that kind of objective data that you could get from the heart monitors and the recordings, again, we're gonna see and try to understand and then report on all of this through our own cultural biases, right? So
right.
If you report to me an ecstatic feeling or something in from a Malaysian point of view, in your religion, I'm going to hear ecstatic in a way that a Christian might understand it, or in the Judeo-Christian tradition.
Right. So there are big differences in the music in Judaism. So we have one and the same prayer, and we have hundreds of different melodies that are sung in the different Jewish cultures around the world. And it doesn't speak the same language to every Jew on this earth. So there are big differences cross-culturally. And
And you've also looked at the way women have taken this, because women historically and traditionally are not cantors. So that's a male province, right?
Sure. I mean, I studied Jewish feminist music here in the U.S., and this even shows that There needs to be an emotional connection to Judaism and its music. How can you say? So the traditional music doesn't speak to anybody today. So so lots of different kinds of music have been invented in Judaism throughout the last 40 years, for example, and the feminists were one of those people who put popular music to revised liturgical texts with a feminist theology in the background, and this package makes it understandable and makes it more spiritual for them, and this is the way how they understand and connect to Judaism.
Well, you know, John, what Sarah says points to another complicating factor, it seems to me, and that is how cultural expectations have an impact on how you will report feeling something emotional. The people around you, if you're going through some desiccated, for you, a kind of dry liturgical experience, and everybody else is shouting and waving their hands, you might take it upon yourself to shout, wave your hands, and, you know, start to feel the passion, right?
Well, yeah, there's such a thing as feeling rules. And you get into certain kinds of environments or certain kinds of settings, the feeling rules can change. You know, we're used to thinking of our emotional lives as these kinds of spontaneous occurrences, and we'd like to protect our own agency as subjects and all of that. But in fact, much of what we feel, and certainly the way we perform it, is a product of culturally derived emotions, cultures, or rules of feeling. Not to say that there's no such thing as love, but the way we talk about love, the way we represent it, the way we behave when we're in love, these things are all conditioned to a certain extent by the cultures we live in.
So, Donovan, that raises questions about, for the more perceptive among us, ways to manipulate that. Once you know the rules, if you become have any kind of authority within the religion and understand the way emotion works and understand that perhaps not everybody knows what's going on with them, makes it easy to manipulate. Is that part of the issue in some of your study?
I think so. I mean, the problem with the category of manipulation is that it's very top-down. It implies that there are people who, say, are not feeling hatred, but are propagating hatred for some kind of personal benefit. I don't know that that's always the case. I think sometimes hatred is something that takes on a life of its own and is bigger than any one particular person and is maybe even bigger than any one particular agenda.
On the State of Things today, we are talking about the emotion and religion, a conference at the National Humanities Center. John Corrigan is a fellow at the National Humanities Center and a scholar of religion and history. Donovan Schaefer is a scholar of religion at Oxford University. And Sarah Ross, an ethnomusicologist at Bern in Switzerland. We're going to talk more about this when our program continues on the State of Things. Do stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. A conference at the National Humanities Center brings scholars together from around the world to talk about religion and emotion. They're going to debate and discuss what emotion is and how it is studied. And all three of them are with me now talking about their research. John Corrigan is a fellow at the National Humanities Center and the conference convener. Donovan Schaefer is a scholar of religion at Oxford University in the UK. Sarah Ross, an ethnomusicologist at the University of Bern in Switzerland. If we think about the relevance of this topic, I mean, one way is to sort of understand better how religion works. But again, culturally and socially, when we see one religion pitted against each other, we see these kinds of tensions all over the world because of religion. John, does this kind of research have any bearing on that? Is there any use to us in trying to sort out those problems in understanding the questions that you're examining?
Yeah, there's a direct relevance to that. You know, one of the reasons I got interested in this was because I was interested in religious intolerance and religious violence and religious hatred. And I wanted to try to figure out if there's a way we can study religious hatred so that it, again, doesn't seem as mysterious if we can find a way to connect religious hatred to these kind of structures of thinking or cognitive structures, ideas that people have about the world that are based on doctrine and scripture and so forth. Maybe if we can start to understand emotion as a connection between thinking and feeling rather than just a kind of extreme, isolated feeling, we'll make some progress in understanding how it is that religious hatred comes about and possibly some steps towards understanding how we can circumvent it.
Well, Donovan, I wonder if you've done any research on this and where your thoughts are at the moment. So many religions have somewhere at their core the idea of love, of mutual love, and of respect for all beings because they come from one or more creators, mm-hmm. which which the practitioners of those religions revere. And yet we don't know a religion that hasn't, in the name of its own religion, caused all kinds of death, violence, and mayhem. And so I suppose this research can help us with the disconnect inside one skull, how one skull can maintain those two ideas and move forward and arm itself and speak out against prayer, as we had one North Carolinian, Franklin Graham, spoke out against prayer in the name of Christianity just recently. Does the research yield any light?
Yeah, I think that's a great way of looking at things. I like that that phrasing of two competing forces inside one skull. I mean, in a certain sense, that's what looking at emotion allows us to do. If you look at a religion as just what people say they think and say they believe, then yes, you're going to see a lot of religions of love, and the things that people do in the name of religion that doesn't look so loving ends up being totally unintelligible to you. But if you look at religion not just as a belief system, but also as a set of emotions that shape the things that you do, the decisions you make, the kinds of relationships that you form with other people, then you start to see religion as having more complicated effects in the world.
Sarah, as you think about the power of music and the impact of music, it is the practice of religion sometimes that is supposed to, in many cases, have a kind of conversion effect, that whatever you thought you were coming into the synagogue, we hope you'll be somewhat changed as you walk out. Music can have this effect. Do you see that it does? Is there a way in which it can mediate in emotional ways, non-rational ways, to change the behavior and either bring these two sides of the skull together or not?
Well, yes, definitely music does this. But what I also observed is that if there are people sitting in the synagogue, for example, in Bern, there is a woman sitting next to me every Shabbat, and she doesn't speak Hebrew, she doesn't speak German, only French. And so there's lots of the parts of the liturgy that she doesn't understand and doesn't get. So ritual music is very much about the knowledgeable and sensitive worshiper who understands how ritual music functions and what it is about. And if you don't understand it, if you don't have this deep insight in ritual music, you maybe get only half of it. But still, I think it does have an effect. If you go to a synagogue on Friday evening, you immediately get into a different kind of mode or mood. Mm.
So. But that's interesting because it does point to the cultural particularity of every religion, however universal it may claim to be. Even within a religion, as it is practiced in different parts of the globe, we'll have a different experience.
Yeah. So if I think about, so about 3 years ago, we got a new cantor, an American one, and so he brought new melodies, and there was a big rumor in this synagogue, in the community, because, he was singing melodies that nobody was used to. And this shows very much what power music has within religion, and that it is very important, actually, to study these aspects of music in terms of improving the communication between each member of a community, to negotiate and.
Well, this brings us, I think, to the ultimate question, or an ultimate question that you may be grappling with, John, and that is whether the kind of raising of these issues to the level of intellectual discourse, what impact it's expected to have. Can religions evolve with a deeper understanding of what it is they do? Most religions have evolved out of some sense of, sort of prophetic mission one way or another. Now you're asking us to say, well, let's think about the impact of religion and how it works on us. Can they be religions still if they were to examine themselves and say, let's be more mindful about how this works, body, mind, and soul, and still be a religion, or would we be something else at that point?
Well, religions don't survive unless they adapt. So over time, religions that survive have figured out a way to bring together the different kinds of ways of being human. We're embodied creatures who think and feel and perform and do all kinds of other things. for religion to be able to continue to be relevant to people, it has to find ways to mix all that stuff together. So, you know, this is just one more step, I think, along the way of how it is that religions negotiate in an ongoing way a position for the people who belong to them to embrace.
Fascinating discussion. I want to thank all of you for being on the program today. John Corrigan is a fellow at the National Humanities Center, a scholar of religion and history. Donovan Schaefer, a scholar of religion at Oxford University. And Sarah Ross, an ethnomusicologist at the University of Bern in Switzerland. Thank you all for being on the program.
My pleasure.
They all join me to talk about a conference at the National Humanities Center tomorrow. You can find out more about the conference and details on how to attend at our website, stateofthings.org.